Okay. Ellen, are you there? Ellen, can you hear me?
I can, just barely, but I can.
Okay, let me talk a little bit
louder.
Oh, there
you go.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so Ellen LeConte is the author of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once, and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. So, Ellen, I just want to get a little background on you. What kind of family did you grow up in when you were a child?
Oh, gosh. I grew up in a very supportive... can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're loud as a bell.
Yeah, I'm getting my feedback, and you're at your end.
How about that?
Okay, we'll try. Yes, good. I grew up in a very happy, supportive, upwardly mobile, middle of the 20th century family. My dad was an aspiring and successful. He went from being an engineer, aeronautical engineer, designing, of all things, as we come out this end, things like the Nike missile back at Glenn L. Martin Company in the day when we thought missiles would stand between us and Russia and various other dangers. But he was very, very good at what he did as an engineer, good with people, and became a very successful, financially and professionally successful executive. We moved as his jobs took us. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I was the eldest of three. We did all the things that sort of the Cleaver family kind of family did in the mid-century. And I don't recall at that time ever thinking of anything gloomy or that things had an end they would come to. We just sort of did the things the family felt like doing with other family members, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. I had bunny rabbits and a canary and various kinds of small pets. We played in the backyard, pogo sticks, hula hoops, jumping rope, the things we did as kids before there were things like iPads and iPods and cell phones and so forth. It was a sort of blissful mid-20th century childhood. And I think that actually that persisted pretty much all the way through my years in college at the University of Michigan, and then as a teacher for several years in Connecticut, all the way until the beginning of the 70s when I kind of caught on with Alvin Toffler and the Arab oil embargo and the beginning of kind of a second wave of homesteading, caught on to the fact that the way I was living, the way a lot of us were living, might not be sustainable and might actually be harmful. And it was a great blow. I spent a while wallowing in guilt and then moved into the process of homesteading with my then-husband and started on this path that led me to this book, Life Rules, which was reading, thinking about, and beginning to practice other ways of being in the world that might not be so harmful to other species and other people in the world.
Now, in your book...
But it didn't come from my childhood. Lots of love, support, happiness, blissful indifference, blitheness. That was my childhood.
Well, so it was basically coming to grips in your college years and seeing the reality of how the world works that sort of made you go to the homesteading lifestyle?
Yes, and it is hard. I'm having a hard time hearing you on your end. I understand you can't shout into the phone.
I'll talk a little louder again.
Okay.
Okay, so your college years, is that what drove you to the homesteading lifestyle?
No, my college years were a continuation. My college years at Michigan were a continuation of the This Is How Life Works, America's Kind of Special, Be Nice to Other People. I never thought about economics or economies, trespasses on other species or other people. The closest we came to that was the beginning of the, Martin Luther King and the beginning of a greater awareness of how our white middle-class, upwardly mobile lifestyle had trespassed on our African-American / Negro / Black, whatever people were choosing at the time, how that had trespassed on for many of our fellow Americans. That was as close as I got to seeing that there was another side to my happiness, which was creating darkness for other people. But the understandings about what my way of living and the American dream, what the consequences of that might be for future generations, for other living things, and for people around the world, didn't hit me literally until the early 70s with my beginnings of reading things like I read Future Shock, Alvin Toffler's Future Shock back then with a lot of other people, and my then husband at the time was a professor of education at the University of Connecticut. And we were recreating that lifestyle I'd had and he'd known in our own lives. And after I read Future Shock, we started to think differently and spent a summer, actually it was a full sabbatical, we spent in Europe. And the last part of it we spent on Crete, on the island of Crete, living in a little cold water flat on the south shore of the island of Crete. And Future Shock, with its sort of vision of a technocratic, high-tech, digital, expansive, global future, clashed so intensely with what we were experiencing in villages in Greece and in that little village on the south shore of Crete, that my mind had one of those things where, you know, the two parts of your story are in terrific conflict. And I came out, my ex-husband and I came out on the side of go smaller, go simpler. Small is Beautiful came out around that time. I read Silent Stream, Silent Spring. Well, we got Silent Streams now, too.
Exactly.
Anyway, the literature of the early and mid-70s clashed with the vision, my life experience, and the vision I had of the future. And I came out on the side of small is beautiful, less is more. It didn't happen in college, and certainly not thanks to any of my teachers in college.
Okay, so then if we can break this down, I started reading your book, but I was trying not to read it, and I came across one part which sort of hits home with me. There's basically topics which are causing the problems in our world, basically population, technology, capitalism, pollution, peak oil, peak water, urbanization, consumerism, industrialism, militarism, and basically you have the term critical mass, which is basically the a term used in a nuclear explosion. When something hits its critical mass, it explodes in a nuclear explosion. So where would you like to start is about talking about where the problem is? I guess we'll talk about what the problem is before we talk about what can fix it.
I think, and this is something, the image that I use in the book, and it's still, I find, a useful one, and I keep getting emails and occasional phone calls and pieces of actual snail mail, to the extent there is much of that anymore, that indicate that this worked for people. The image I use in the book is an analogy of what's going on in the world with what goes on in the human body when it becomes infected with HIV. The special horrible thing about the human immunodeficiency virus is that it undermines exactly the system that has been designed over millions of years of evolution to prevent that AIDS virus from taking over the body completely. It undermines the capacity of the immune system to defend the body, to protect the body, to heal the body. And essentially, the global economic model in other places, I don't use this term in the book, but I call it the global economic order, in capital letters, GEO, the global economic order under which we've lived for the past, it's been coming on for about 500 years, but we've really been living in a global economic order where a global economy triumphs over national and local economies for about 60 years. And the global economic order, the way it works, is consumptive, expansive, extractive, It will take everything in its path in order to grow, exactly as the HIV virus does in the human body. And what that means is that human and natural communities all around the world, and we're among the last ones to really feel it and know it, and we know that when we open the newspaper this morning and find out, or turn on our computers and go to MSNBC and find out that the Dow plunged 664 points or some such yesterday. It has fallen 15% in the last couple of weeks. And that is, in my book, I have a chapter called Too Big Not to Fail. And that's what this economy is now. And it's too big not to fail the same way that HIV in the body is too big not to fail. When the human immunodeficiency virus is successful in a host body, when it isn't treated or held off in some fashion, it dies in the body along with the host. Well, this economy has now run up against the capacity of money, natural resources, ecosystems, the planet. It's run up against the planet's, the Earth's ability to provide for it. And that's where I start out in the book, and that's where I think the problem is. It's not with all the small things we're tinkering with, individual things like climate change, peak oil, population. All of these have been enabled by this economy. Until we back away from, stop growing that economy, we won't be really dealing with the central issue.
And the central issue being that we are living way beyond our means and not dealing with our surroundings, like being part of our environment. We tend to think of ourselves as being separate. It's like,
that's right. We think of ourselves as being larger than life as a species, as somehow being able to outthink the way living systems work. And that's not the case. There's a popular phrase circulating now. I think Robert Jensen just had an article, a post in the Energy Bulletin. And Bob and I have been trading these ideas back and forth for a little while now, and the main title of it is, which is a popular phrase, is Nature Bats Last. And essentially, in a baseball season, what that means is last one up at the plate, in this case, is life itself, nature, the living systems on the planet, and what it does to species that overreach, as we're doing, is render them extinct. And that's the possibility we're facing.
Basically. Well, linking population and technology together. I mean, everyone thinks, okay, technology is going to save us, but then technology tends to make life somewhat easier in a sense, at least on the outside.
That's right.
We never see the garbage, the pollution it creates, and the havoc in other countries it creates, and what it does to other people producing the technology. But how do you see technology and population being one of the problems?
Getting into this equation?
Yes.
We're dealing with a population of 7 billion, and if the economy, if this were able, which I strongly believe it's not, to persist off into the end of the century, I mean, we're hitting so many scarcities and crises at this point that the system, I strongly believe, will collapse well before we're looking at the end. Before our children and grandchildren are looking at the end of the century, if it were allowed to persist, the thought is that there could be 9 billion of us by 2050. That possibility that's been made possible by, exactly as you say, technologies, particularly food production technologies, that, and to a certain degree, which it's beginning to fail. Making water available and making some sorts of health care and vaccines available, those technologies have allowed, and technologies that have allowed us to live in parts of the planet which, if we didn't have them, air conditioning, heat, cars, airplanes, if we didn't have those technologies, we couldn't be living in many of the parts of the world where we're living now. Human life, larger than small tribes, wouldn't be sustainable. All of these technologies have made it possible for humans to live longer than, more of us than, and in more places than we would be able to otherwise. So the two are totally intertwined, but they're both supported by, and again, if you're looking to solve a problem, you try to look at the root or basic, the fundamental underlying cause that explains all of the symptoms you're facing. And the single feature that has made technological expansion and willfulness and this tremendous expansion of the population possible has been a globalized economy. Money flowing, fake money, funny money, but the idea of money floating around the planet supporting both the technology and the population it supports.
So do you believe the global economy is part of the problem, a big part of the problem?
It's the fundamental underlying cause. It's the facilitator of all the problems that we've identified separately, like excessive overpopulation and expansive, unrestrained, thoughtless technology.
It seems like the concept, since we've gone global, it's like it's such a big world and we can basically do whatever we want. And people don't think of the Earth as a finite resource like a fishbowl.
Right, exactly.
And then they
a basic fact is every economy of every kind, every technology, every population, every size of population, but let's start with the economy because right now the way we think and behave economically seems to be the underlying chief problem, cause of the problems, the various problems, the critical mass of converging problems we're facing. Every economy of every kind on a finite planet is dependent on the largest economy of which it's a part. And for example, our economy now is clearly dependent on what happens with the global economy. And if we weren't ever going to learn that before, certainly in the last couple of years, we have been forced to learn that what goes on in Europe, Japan, Greece, what goes on in a very small country like Greece can have an impact all over the world, rippling through that global economy. Every economy is dependent on the largest one of which it's a part. The global economy, human economy, is not the largest one on this planet. The largest economy on this planet is the living life economy, the provisional, the things that life provides us, which if we don't have, no economy can function. And the global human economy is running up against that largest economy of all and its capacity to support us.
Yeah, I would say probably around, at least for me, World War II was the start of people forgetting about the environment and their surroundings because technology,
absolutely,
the TV dinner came into play and the microwave and all this stuff. And they forget why we're here, how we were here, and how long we lived before we had all these toys. And granted, things may not have been always the best in the past, but I figure the planet and people, it just was a natural thing. People died, there were population explosions, but at the same time, the population would be wiped out. Where now we try to be above it all, and we try to make everything last longer, have bigger, better things, but we don't think about the garbage and waste we create, which sickens the planet and sickens us. I mean, how do you see cancer and diabetes? I mean, do you think that's something that's been around for a long time or has sort of exploded in the past couple decades?
You've nailed a good one there, because the dark side of all the good we think we've created and the convenience and the comfort extended lifetimes, extended lives. I mean, living into our 80s, 90s, you know, we talk about hundreds. We seem to have an unwillingness as a modern species. Modern humans, American-styled modern humans, have most of them, us, have a real hard time facing the idea of the ends of things, particularly of our own lives. But most of the diseases that we say the healthcare system can no longer afford to support, like diabetes, certain kinds of cancer, certainly lung cancer, smoking-induced lung cancer. We forget that where you live, in what kind of city or out in the country, has a lot to do with that, with lung cancer as well. Urban lifestyles are not good for the lungs. But essentially, our current lifestyle that we defend as if it were the only lifestyle is killing us. We've become slack, obese. Obesity is a huge factor. Diabetes is huge. These are diseases of a spoiled species eating food that's been processed and had the nutrients taken out of it, essentially, and synthetics put into it, of water that has been treated or has pollutants in it, air that is polluted, stresses that people didn't used to have. The lifestyles we talk about being so awful, actually people lived rather well and worked many less hours a day. When a shift to acquiring money occurred, because money was the way we would live, we moved away from producing the provisions that we actually need, providing for ourselves. We stopped providing for ourselves and started acquiring money. It's a huge stress on the nervous system, because you're not in control of money that you might acquire, whereas we had in most settings some control, apart from bad weather, climate changes that occurred naturally, or bad seasons of rainfall, whatever. We had some control over our provisions, the things that we needed to live.
Well,
and that shift has made us sick.
Well, and everyone says that we live longer now than we used to, but I tend to go to a lot of old cemeteries, and I see people living in their 70s, late 80s.
Yeah.
And the whole thing now is people live longer because they're basically in nursing homes, they're put on medication, they're put on machines,
yes.
And the value of life, it's not even life. I mean, they're basically vegetables on a bed. It's like, and again, to me, that's preserving life for the sake of cash flow, money, capitalism. It's not making it a better life that we live. Saying, oh, look, we're able to live till 96.
Well, and it's also a fear of death. I mean, we do have, as a modern species that has, ironically, in this country, the Christian tradition in this country talks about heaven and hell, which may be the issue for some deeply believing conservative fundamental Christians, but it doesn't really deal with end of life issues and with the end of life moving beyond life, leaving life as a natural part of the process. And people are terrified of coming to an end, and we've, by going hands off and as precisely as you say, moving this into a nursing home, somebody else provides the care. We've lost our familiarity with dying and death, and our comfort with it, and our comforting other people through it. We let somebody else do that. We flee from it. And that's unnatural. It's another aspect of our having become unnatural, detached from, and we think larger than life.
Well, and that also goes at the beginning of life, birth. I mean, people are so involved in their, trades and their occupations that they don't think about the children. They don't want to take the time to raise and teach your children.
Farm them out.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We farm them out early on and I understand what this again comes back to, what I call funny money in the book, and others have called the paper money economy and faux money. Money that's actually not really based on anything any longer, no gold standard, no something that helps limit how much of it there can be. And so we have had a sense that money is infinite also, and it can grow. The amount of it can expand forever. We forget about inflation when that happens.
Yes.
Put that off to the side, which we've been able to do, just as you say, since the end of, since the end of World War II. And we farm our kids out because we have to be busy making money instead of taking care of them as part of how we provide for them and ourselves. They have become a kind of commodity to us.
Well, yeah, and then you try to substitute the love and the nurturing with things, which then you have to have that second job to furnish the things instead
exactly.
of living a simpler life and
that's right.
being a stay-at-home mom or dad. And dealing with your family. And people, I don't think, really know what a family is. I mean, I chose not to have a family, and one reason I did that is because of population. I see population spiraling out of control.
That's
I just
right.
talked to someone who just had 5 kids because they've been divorced. You know, it's like, okay, so to show your love, you must have another child. But they don't think about how it just grows exponentially. It's like when the whole money issue went down again, and someone says, oh, well, let's just print up more money. It's like, well, that's the problem. I mean, basically what I think our money's backed by, it's backed by debt.
Yes, yes.
Which is strange and odd.
It's sort of like saying it's backed by nothing.
Right? Worse than nothing.
Yes, worse than nothing, because it costs us something even though it's the absence of anything. I mean, debt is the absence of sufficient money, and yet somehow we're supposed to come up with money to pump back into that hole we just dug. Which requires growing and in moving into more debt. Yes. The ironies heaped on ironies. And that's really what I've tried to address in my book, Life Rules, is that all of these issues are tied together. And they're tied together by one cause, which is this economic globalization. And the things that it has led us to, like the printing of more and more money till it means nothing. And then, you know, what is the alternative? Well, you've been, you know, dancing around it here because you clearly know this, Tim, already, which is why having this conversation turns out to be so easy. There is an alternative way of being in the world, and life has taught that way of being for the last couple of billion years. Interestingly enough, the very first species on this planet, forms of bacteria, single-celled microbes, in the first 2 billion years of the life experiment on Earth, those single-celled creatures went through exactly the same process, although, you know, not with technologies and money, but they created a pollution crisis, they created an energy crisis, and they created a scarcity crisis, exactly as we've been doing. And then finally, somehow, these brainless, single-celled bacteria learned how not to do that anymore. And every living thing on this planet is the result of those brainless, single-celled creatures learning how not to create critical mass, how to live within the planet's means. And they did that by learning to live together, sharing information, sharing the resources, downsizing their economy instead of going global, using a solar economy. The lessons are all there in the second part of the book. Life teaches us exactly how else we might live, sustainably, kindly, thoughtfully, more humanely than we're actually doing now.
Well, it's like most animals, their bodies have adapted, and their bodies tell them when there's enough food or when temperatures are too hot, and then they don't produce, where we tend to fight that. I mean, and it's like, in vitro fertilization, okay, you're not meant to have a child, but yet we have technology that will give you the right to have the child. But at the same time, that's sort of like, you know, selective, let's decide who produces and not. But that's like the environment telling you that. But we want to fight against that just on a simple, basic level like that, because we want it. We have the technology to change it, but maybe there's a reason why that person isn't supposed to produce.
Yes, life teaches species to cut back their populations and their consumption, in some cases to hibernate, but certainly to trim back, to curtail activity when times are hard. And the irony is, you know, people in Washington are talking about that curtailing thing, that cutting back. And we're fighting that, too. I mean, you know, the global economy is now telling us that we need to trim our expenses. But that is going to mean hardship, and we really don't want to face the hard reality, and nobody in Washington really wants to help us figure out how to do that. They just want to cut out the poor, cut out the elderly, cut out the social programs. In a way, life works like that. It's that harsh. We're supposed to be clever enough to explain that to people, to make that somehow a goal rather than a punishment. And right now the mechanisms in Washington that are trying to trim us back are allowing the top 1% to not trim back, to continue to expand and grow and become wealthier, while the rest of us take it on the chin.
Right. Well, and that's like people telling me, well, the United States population is going down. It's like, yes, it's going down, but you're basically 5% of the population, and you use up 30% of the resources.
Exactly. We may be getting smaller in numbers. Part of that's because immigration has slowed and is reversing. But, you know, we get smaller in numbers, and yet we consume more and more and more. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to stop. Because, I mean, I've talked to people that have come to this country, and then they're like, wow, it's sort of hard. I mean, you get a lot of toys, but they find that you get hooked on all these toys you don't need, which then you have all these bills that you didn't have when you were back in your home country, and then you realize, boy, it's all messed up, and before you know it, you're caught up in it.
That's right. And at that point, many of your family members back in the home country, again, because this is a money-based, and not that money itself, money is not the root of all evil. I think the actual passage is something more like love of money is the root of all evil. But funny money, such as we have now, that, on which we've become dependent, you know, people here, immigrants here, end up sending, not end up, in many cases they had planned to send that money home to help the people at in their home countries, in their homelands, to do better in a money economy. And ironically, if you just, which may happen by default over the next little while here, if the money is suddenly worth a whole lot less, you can begin to price things at their actual value and begin to live within your means and attach money to real things. Right now it's not backed by, as you said, anything but debt. There's nothing supporting the monetary system.
So you talk about living within our means. So what are some suggestions you can give to the average person here on what they can do to start? I mean, just start, because a lot of people, they're so dumbfounded. They get into all these trends, but they don't actually live the lifestyle. They're like, oh, yeah, that's great, farmers markets, local food, yet they really don't support it. You know,
yeah, right. Well, and that I've written some articles recently that, you know, the best thing, of course, is if you can grow. I mean, when we think about it, the basic issues are some sort of health, medicine, health care. Ironically, if we were to live much more simply, we'd have many fewer conditions that needed to be treated. If we weren't traveling around the world and our diseases weren't traveling around the world, we'd have fewer the contagious diseases, fewer of them to deal with. But if you can grow some of your own food, preferably in a community, a backyard, for example, even patios, street sides, what do you call that strip that runs down the middle of the highway that
Meridian
with all the
strip.
Grass on it that's usually just mowed. I mean, there are any number. There's plenty of land in this country, except in the desert areas. There's plenty of land on which food could be grown. Food doesn't have to be an issue. Buying it in a store is an issue. Producing enough of it to make us healthy, to keep us alive, to support quality of life, we can do that together in our communities, or we can nurture people who can do that, small farmers, community farmers, farmers markets. Heating and cooling, we may have to deal with a little less of those. We may have to learn to live like people did in the 1950s when you had modest heating systems and no air conditioning. And it is possible to learn how to live without that. Again, people did for a very long time. Some health care, a lot of what's provided in hospitals now either wouldn't be needed or could be provided by people in much smaller, simpler settings taking care of each other. Transportation, if we have no global economy, we don't need to get everything and ourselves from one side of the planet to the other, and transportation can be scaled down. But these, you asked, you know, what can we do? Food would be an essential issue. Trimming our use of electricity, learning to live with less of what we consider to be the obvious conveniences, like being able to hop in the car and go to the store to get a pack of cigarettes or a bottle of milk. These things probably don't happen until there's a critical mass, which doesn't require a majority. A critical mass can be a point as small as 5% or 10% of something that triggers a conversion, a set of conversion behaviors, a changed state. And a critical mass of people beginning to do these things becomes more than just a fad. It becomes a movement. But it does. People are not going to do so much of this. Not so many people will do these sorts of things, the simplification, downscaling things, until their friends and co-workers and family are doing it too. So the first step really is persuasion. Make it attractive. Do it. Persuade people. Join up with people. Create that that sense of this being something that's not only necessary but also desirable.
So buying, going local with our food, because basically food's a commodity, and it's something that I feel in a lot of cases, corn, soybean, et cetera, we overproduce, which then we export, same with milk. So then, like in Jamaica, we'll export powdered milk, then we'll put the farmers out of business there.
Right.
So by bringing it back to local and bringing it to sustainable levels, producing the amount of food for your area, it may be some excess, but not so much excess that you're going to go into basically other markets.
That's right.
Which I guess is what, to me, has created the problems, because you want to produce more and more and more, and you want to send, like Vermont wants to send it to Boston and all that stuff.
And because, again, the object is to produce money rather than to produce, rather than to provide, rather than to produce provisions or provide for ourselves, we are producing to make money. If you take that part out of the equation, and monetary systems can be redesigned practically overnight. Alexander Hamilton did that in the early 19th century, creating a centralized bank. We made one currency for the whole U.S. There had been, you know, scores of currencies around the colonies until that moment. We can reinvent, and people are there. I think there are like 200 communities now in the U.S. that have alternative local currencies that are helping to keep quote unquote money, but more than that, keep jobs, locally produced food, locally produced trades, services in the community, keep them local and support them locally. All of these things can be done once we know we need to do them.
Well, it's how to get people to go on the local idea, you know, because I talk to people all the time, and it's like, you know, so, you know, you want people to come to your business, but yet you're going to go outside of this area to get other things instead of, okay, George over here has what I need, but, oh, it's 30 cents more than what I would be paying if I went to Burlington.
Walmart,
exactly. Okay, you said it. But,
yes,
you know,
I did. Yes, the Walmartization of the world.
Yeah, but the time,
it's
the
not,
money.
I laugh, but it's not funny. It's not in the least bit funny.
Well, it's a sick joke, which is the harsh reality, because, you know, when you talk about this kind of stuff, if you don't laugh at it, you'll go crazy and then nothing's going to happen.
That's right.
Because it is a joke, which is the sad part about it, except it's a joke. It's like the killing joke, sort of like Monty Python, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they were ahead of the curve, for sure.
Yeah, there's been a lot of warning signs.
Yeah, I think my, and it makes me sad that this is true, but I think there will be James Lovelock, who was one of the, well, the primary original founder of the Gaia, or Gaia hypothesis, the idea that living systems, the community, the whole Earth community of living systems, life forms on the planet, work in a variety of ways together to create, you know, the air, water quality, soils, and all of that that allow us to live. And a couple of interesting things about that. One is that although they work together sympathetically, empathetically, they work together, the living systems, as a whole system, whole Earth system, they do that one community, one location, one ecosystem at a time, each one being responsible for its own provisions, allows all the others to be responsible for their own provisions. And the global economy is a collection of local economies, which is what we're really going to have to learn again. And that's in the book as well. One of the big lessons that life teaches us about how not to have the problems we're having is to work out of economies that are local, bring that money home. And I started out with Lovelock. Lovelock wrote in one of his recent books, I think The Revenge of Gaia, that he foresees collapse, economic collapse, and the further collapse of some of the Earth's ecosystems because of climate change, because of a worsening climate. And he foresees what he calls islands of survival. Speaking of humans in this case, and some of them will literally be islands, and others will be pockets of sustainable communities that have learned proactively how to live within their means around the world. And I think probably he's got that right. I don't think enough of us are going to decide that we need to do these things, go local, for example, before this system actually collapses. When it does, we'll have no choice but to go local. And that's when we'll learn it. We'll just learn it then under duress with fewer resources left to use than if we were to do this proactively.
Interesting. And we are talking to Ellen LeConte of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. And if you'd like to see more on Ellen, you can go to Ellen, LACONTE.com. So when you're talking about that, that makes me think, okay, so a lot of these countries and people that are roughing it and barely surviving now, and people always say that they're going to feel it hardest. I mean, maybe I'm sort of thinking at this moment that they're not going to feel it hardest. The people that are spoiled, soft, they're the ones that are going to basically die because they haven't toughened up, where these other people have learned to live with marginal. I mean, barely surviving in a lot of cases. Again, not really being able to curb the population concept, because that seems to always be an issue with humans. They're sort of like rabbits. But, I mean, do you think possibly that the countries and the people that are poor actually will survive this better than, you know, the West?
Yeah, and I think if you're not talking about numbers, it may not be that numbers of them will survive.
Right.
Because if you look at something like, you know, what's going on in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia and Ethiopia, and the borders in Kenya, places on the planet that have been the most abused and were already the most sensitive, this would now be starting, of course, with desert places where they can't produce food enough to feed as many of them, as many people as there are. I don't mean to use the word them because that sounds dismissive. They entered the monetary economy when we required them to, when we colonized them in order to get at their various resources. And stuck in that monetary economy, they had to have more children because a lot of them would die, and if they didn't have enough children to work in that monetary economy, they couldn't support themselves. But there won't be massive numbers of people, but the people who have lived poor in this country and in the what we have called the third world countries are much more accustomed to hardship and, yes, are apt to feel this much less than most of us living in first, quote-unquote, first-world economies will. I remember I lived in Maine, and you're in Vermont, so you appreciate there are things I miss about Maine. I'm in North Carolina now, but and a variety of reasons for that. But my sort of happiest, most productive years, I think, were the almost 25 years I lived in Maine. And I had a friend whose family was a dairy farming family, and they had a passel of children, all of whom went on to be farmers of one kind or another. But I remember my friend Minnie Raven saying their family never noticed the Great Depression. Nothing was much different than it had been before. They were still milking cows. They were still raising potatoes and raising their own food and putting it by. They were still heating with wood. It didn't change anything for them. And she said, you know, we didn't have as much as a lot of other people had, but we didn't lose it either.
Well, exactly. That's the way I feel, because during Reagan's time, it didn't really affect me too much. And now I'm not really feeling it either, because, you know, I figure there's a certain income when it starts to affect you, because you get more tied into the whole system, and that's what makes it the problem. If you live simpler, you can still have all the stuff. I mean, I'll still travel abroad and all of that stuff, but at the same time, I don't really feel affected by the whole thing. So, and I'm feeling basically what's going to have to happen here for this planet, not the planet, but the human race to survive, is 2/3 of the population will probably have to disappear. I mean, sounds radical.
When we use terms like have to, it sounds like we're deciding, and in effect we are, by the way. We continue to live as a species. We have decided, without realizing it, that that's what's going to have to happen. When we've already hit critical mass. If we push further and further into that, you know, you go with a, as you said, with a nuclear with nuclear fission, you know, at some point it goes from just being warm in there to being an explosion. And we're in the warming, literally, phase of this critical mass. But we will hit, at the rate we're going, we will hit that explosive, implosive process before very long. And it will, that will cause the downsizing of the species and our appetites and our economies and our ways of living. It's not that that number of people will have to, it just simply will. Yeah,
basically. I mean, I don't know. Just from looking around, that's the number or percent or whatever I come up with, because, I mean, it's like we're so beyond what's happening. I mean, if you just look from World War II to now, the amount of fuel that we've gone in, if just take that one commodity, I mean, it's insane. And then they always go, oh, well, there'll be more for like 100 years, but it gets harder to get. You're not changing your habits. I mean, like in the 70s when the first oil peak hit, I mean, we were starting to change. I mean, 1980, you had a Honda Accord that was getting 40 miles a gallon and stuff like that. And then where did it all go? You know, and it's like we...
this is where the globalization process kicked up another notch, and we learned politically and militarily how to acquire more of what we wanted from places like the Middle East and the northern part of South America, and we learned how to get more with money and power. And when people don't understand the nature of the complex systems they live in, which Americans and most people around the world don't understand the nature of complex systems, they don't see that when you push over here in a web in a complex system, it tears out a piece over on the other side. And until, you know, the web is pretty well torn to shreds, they don't see that that's what they've been participating in, is the tearing up of the web of life that supported them. And of course people are going to want, you know, we're not that evolved a species yet. We're only a couple of million, well, actually, modern humans are only maybe 100, 150,000 years old. We haven't had enough time to learn these things, but we have had enough intelligence to destroy a lot of what we don't understand. And we've literally gotten away with murder for a long time. And if you can have comfort, why not, if you don't see that it's going to cause massive discomfort down the road?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's like when I was down in Peru visiting friends and stuff. It was, to me, the country itself was very sustainable. Like, if you went to a restaurant and you got a napkin, I mean, literally, it would be one square of toilet paper. And everyone ate really neat. But then when I came back to the United States, I would get like a 4-inch stack of BevNaps for one beer. But then basically what we preach is the Western idea. It's like, oh, well, you're going to be more intelligent. You want to be a lawyer, a doctor, and then you're going to be able to have this and that. And they're moving further and further away from their own culture and really their own sustainability. I mean, people aren't always doing that well, but I mean, what is doing well? That's my whole big dilemma. What is doing well? You know, okay, so you're not washing your clothes every day. You're not changing your clothes. You only have a couple pairs of pants and a couple shirts, and that's considered poor, and oh, you're doing so bad. But to me...
And that's always comparative. You're only doing so bad if there's a whole lot of people or a bunch of people around you that have a whole lot more somehow.
Right.
Otherwise, you're not doing so bad if everybody else is sort of like you are.
Well, exactly. And then everyone thinks, okay, we're going to go to space and technology is going to grow and we're going to travel the galaxy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking about life here, you know, it's like when you see all these sci-fi movies, everyone's living in the clouds. Why are they living in the clouds? Because they destroyed their planet.
Yes, we destroyed our base planet.
You know?
Oh, and, you know, and we might consider creating missiles sufficient to carry, to go out to asteroids and land on them and farm their metals and bring them back, missing completely the point that one of the things that we're really running out of, running low on affordable fuel, fossil fuels. And when we don't have those, I mean, there is nothing about the modern lifestyle that continues when fossil fuels become too expensive and then scarce and then not available. I mean, it's all over. It's done. And we are entering that time period, and people don't seem to have gotten that peak oil. I do there's an exercise in Life Rules in the book called the ABCs of, what did I call it? The ABCs of, not subtraction. Peak Oil, I guess it's called. I gave it a bunch of different names in different settings, but literally asking people who are reading that page to go through a practice of subtracting one category at a time, things that are dependent on fossil fuels, starting with, for example, everything that's wrapped in plastic or contained in plastic, everything, because plastics are one of the things that go away when we don't have sufficient petroleum. Everything that it ends up with, everything that comes from more than 250 miles away. If you go through this list and work the list, you realize, the idea would be that readers would realize, whoa, if we're hitting peak fossil fuels, there's almost nothing in my house or Lifeway that I'm going to have. That's a pretty heavy realization. And one which we're living into now, not just having to think about.
Oh, for sure. And you're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, and we are here with our guest, Ellen LaConte, and that would be Ellen, LaConte.com, and her book is Life Rules. Well, and you're going into peak oil, which then goes into peak water. You know, it all...
Peak water? Peak food, you take those two away, and you take away imported food. Peak cheap money. I call it the end of cheap easy, cheap hyphen easy. We have been accustomed to cheap in every category: energy, gasoline, heating, food, water, money. We've been able to borrow that cheaply, no interest, for the first 2 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things, all of the things that support our Lifeway, the cheap, easy things, are coming into, the significant ones that support our Lifeway are coming to a conclusion, the end of cheap, easy. And you can, each one plays into the other. Water is a huge, huge issue to which we still give almost no thought in this country, unless we live, you live in I was going to say Las Vegas, but they haven't given thought to cheap water, or are only beginning to now.
I hear they're paying people to tear up their green yards and go with a desert motif.
Absolutely.
But they're having to pay them to do that instead of them doing it on their own, which drives me insane.
Really. Rather than simply requiring it, let's say, because people won't do these things unless they're paid. We're back to the money again.
Well,
unless somebody pays you, you're not going to do the hard thing.
Right. It's like we're $1.7 billion in debt, and our governor has decided, let's bring engineers and skilled labor up here, so let's give them $1,500 a year for up to 5-6 years, yet we have engineers and people up here that have been unemployed for a year.
I'm
confused on where people are coming from when they think about how to solve the problems, because again it comes back to that money, the money that is backed by nothing, and it's a dilemma.
Well, it's like it's an addiction like any other addiction. Until it makes you sick enough or kills you, or somehow all the props of it, you can't get it anymore, you don't give it up. It's what you know. It's what you crave. It's your identity is tied up in money, in how much you have, your comfort level, your expectations, your whole vision of the world is tied up in this, and it's hard for people. Humans are not, by and large, a nasty, unkind, unpleasant, or brutal species until they're pushed hard enough. Most humans are pretty kindly, but they have not had reason to think these things through, and God knows the powers that be and the systems in place have no desire for us to catch on to this, because the ones that are benefiting from this the most don't want us to quit and do something else. That's not a good plan.
Well, and that's the whole problem. I guess the too big to fail idea. You just keep going on the same path, and you're expecting things to change, but yet you're doing nothing to change them. And
that's
right. Here we have a Democratic president, yet the EPA is losing its teeth, And so if it's going to lose its teeth under a Democratic president, what's going to happen when it goes back to Republican? I mean, to me, Democrat, Republican, it's the same party. There really is no difference. It's like
it's the same bad cop.
They're
in support of the same system. You've got that. I mean, absolutely right. It's the system we're talking about, and they are all in one way or another creatures of and need to support and for their own sense of themselves, and certainly to get any kind of campaign funds, any money in their pockets, there we go with money again, to get what they need, which is money to run the next time, they have to feed the managers and owners of the system, and that's the powers that be, the top 5-10% in any country. You got to keep them happy because they've got the biggest supply of money.
Right, so the power would basically have to come from the bottom. But how do you convince people that there has to be change? I mean, have you thought about this?
This has dogged. I mean, we've got books, scads of books, and people who have made their careers and their avocation, their life work, out of how do you persuade? And obviously, the ones that learned how to do advertising to sell things have done a very good job of that. But how do you persuade people to do a hard thing? The reality, as far as I can see it, is that the only time sufficient numbers of humans have literally changed their minds or had their minds changed, and literally, again, their minds, not just their minds, but the way the brain works, every leap in consciousness, every change, major change in the way people have lived, thought about themselves, seen the world, has come exactly in a period of critical mass. And the difference is, I have that the next to the last chapter of my book briefly traces those periods of change in the evolution, in the way humans have thought and behaved. And every one of them has come at a time when climate change or imperial trespass and ecosystem collapse or some other major force has given them no choice. They've had to change literally or die. And I don't see that it's going to be any different this time.
Right. So do you believe that we're coming up on a critical mass, or we're actually entering it?
We're in it now. I mean, because we have entered critical mass, in this case, in the book, is like the nuclear fission process, a sufficient number of crises converging, and like HIV does in the body, influencing, amplifying, multiplying crises that are working together, amplifying each other, to a point where something breaks. And in this case, either the ecosystem, the life as we know it, breaks, or the economy does. One of these two is going to give out, and we would hope, harsh as it sounds, that the economy gives out first. We can live past this economy. This global economy, if you were to think of all of human history as a 24-hour day, the global economy gets like less than the last 30 seconds of that day. The whole rest of human history, we've lived without one. Certainly we can live without one again. If that collapses first, we still have a relatively livable planet to work with. If the climate is allowed to continue to change, we may not have a planet we can live on.
Well, and that's the sad part. It is such a small amount of time, but has done immense damage.
Yes.
I'm into the whole world being buddy-buddy and all that stuff, but it has to be separate in a sense just to protect itself.
And, our idea that of the philanthropists and of good humans who think we need to take care of the people in Africa, we need to take care of the people in South America, wherever there are people hungry and hurting, that goes away if you can't get there anymore or if there isn't sufficient money to get there anymore. But the best thing we can do for most of these people, could have done for the last century, would be to leave them alone. The reason most people, like you said about the sickness, the illnesses, diseases we have now that result from our way of living in a globalized, high-tech, polluting, extractive economy, most of those diseases are the result of our own behaviors. Most of the people in the world now, apart from the fact that there are too many of them in places where there shouldn't be so many, would be a lot better off if we hadn't colonized them and taken most of their resources. The solution to this is going to be local and regional, And that means that the people on the other side of the planet get to be and will have to be local and regional also and figure out where they live, what they have to work with, and how to live in the ecosystems, ecologies that they have to work with.
Well, that, yeah. See, it's like when the Rockefellers and a bunch of other rich folk decided that they wanted to feed the world, which mm-hmm. basically led into the Dust Bowl in this country because we overproduced. We just raped, pillaged our land, destroyed it. You sent food to other countries. You
That's
collapsed
right.
their markets. You know, it's saying that we want to help people, but in reality, nothing's for free, and we want something. You know, it can look like it's the greatest, nicest thing. It's like, oh, let's go rebuild Iraq or Afghanistan, yet we're not using the local labor. We're bringing in our own. We're bringing in...
That's right. It's part of our expanding militarily, our control. I mean, the places that we're doing battle in are the places where the last easy to get at oil, natural gas, and coal are. And the only reason we aren't doing that in China is that the Chinese got powerful enough militarily, politically, and economically that we can't go in there and take what they've got. They're consuming their own fast enough anyway at this point. They are now becoming importers of these resources, which is pretty scary, too, when they're competitive with Europe and the U.S. For those last resources. This could get to be pretty unpleasant, and the Chinese have already decided to begin to call in their cards. You know, they've made it clear that, and they hold the majority of our treasury bonds. They've decided to make it clear that they think we can't continue, the U.S. can't continue to grow on a debt basis, and they can tell us what to do. The shoe's going to be on the other foot here. We're going to be the ones that are in debt and have to follow somebody else's dictates. But this, until it crashes, we're not going to do something different. And it's a case of, like I say, which thing goes down first. Harsh as it is, it's better if the economy collapses and we can figure out with what we have left to work with how to make good lives for an appropriate number of us, which might be, you know, less than a billion, but it certainly wouldn't be 7 billion. The next generations will have to figure this out the way every generation of every species and every generation of humans has had to do forever.
Right. It's like listening to a song the other day. It's like the song's basically going, why should I care? Because my parents have screwed it all up anyway.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a negative thing, but at the same time, it's true. But unfortunately, it will take new minds to change the way things are going. So with global warming, do you feel that it's all man-made or it's a combination of just natural trends the planet does?
It would appear that we should be at this point if natural patterns were holding and given upper atmosphere temperatures, we should be in a cooling phase. Our activities have been sufficient not only to warm us more than is appropriate, faster than has ever happened in a natural cycle. I mean, there have been decades, changes in climate patterns, global climate patterns, that have occurred within a period of a decade. So that's, it can happen naturally. We're forcing it, but we're apparently forcing it hard enough that we're actually working against what ought to be a cooling period. And that's going to throw off all kinds of natural systems that will have to respond to this warming and aren't prepared for it. It hasn't occurred in a way that they can keep up with. Species migrations, disease pest migrations, plants that, you know, can't live when it's as warm as it is, and we depend on those plants for food or shade or firewood. Other species will make their adjustments, but they may not be pleasant for us, those adjustments.
Right. Yeah, ongoing. Well,
yeah.
Interesting. So we've covered a fair amount here, and I'm sure when people read the book, there will be even more for them to check out, because it's as I say, I read the first 25 pages, and it sort of made me not feel alone, because I'm always feeling alone, because I'm always talking, I guess, I'm the doom and gloom guy at the party that everyone wants to get away from, because I can't help but see the reality around me. It's like moving to New England 20-something years ago, when I first got up here, like winters, it'd be negative 10, but it'd be very dry. Now it's become humid, like the south where I'm from. Summer's humidity. It's all the same thing, and there's definitely a massive change that has happened.
Yes, and I've noticed that. I go back to Maine. My dad still lives in Maine on the coast, and I go up several times a year. And the thing, in just in the 10 years since I moved here to North Carolina, I did the reverse of your process coming south from New England after years of, I lived in New England most of my early adult life. Going back up, now I find that in the summer, where it used to cool off at night, as you said, it's now humid enough that the temperatures don't drop at night. And New Englanders and crops in New England and ecosystems in New England aren't accustomed to that.
Right, and it changes. And then your crops will change, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
It's an ongoing thing. So urbanization, I mean, that will also probably, I mean, I don't know. It's funny because I was hearing recently that people from the country are moving towards the cities.
To the city.
And that's the Depression era again. It's like, okay.
Yes. Well, and again, it's about so long as what we're after, so long as we believe that what we need to live is money, we're going to go where we think there's more of it. And that means going where we think there are more jobs, more possibility of making money. And that, you know, that's the urban areas, the suburbs, the cities. The irony is this is a time when actually more people probably should be moving out of the cities back to the small towns. And that will happen. This trend will reverse itself. But, yeah, it's pretty interesting for me to watch that happening, a trend that's counter to everything I understand about what we need to do to provide for ourselves. And moving into the city isn't it.
Right, it taxes the systems of the cities. I mean, but then people say, oh, we don't want sprawl at the same time. But then it's like, I don't know, to me, you got to spread it out some, because concentrations of people, large concentrations of people, are dangerous, like New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago. It's just
right.
Too much in one area, which then again, I mean, it always goes back to population. I harp on this all the time, and nobody wants to change that. I mean, how do you get people to get in their head that population, I mean, at least to me, it's one of the major problems. I mean, our lifestyle for sure, but population, because everyone has the dream of having the 2.5 children and
mm-hmm.
all that stuff because your grandparents did, and for some reason it's a natural thing you do when you get married, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't know how to get through to people that there needs to be less of that. I mean, people give China grief for the one-child policy, but at the same time, it helped their population go down. It messed up the male-female ratio, but at the same time, their population is still going up exponentially.
And ironically, I mean, there's another one. In the face of an aging population in China, as here, you know, when you're talking about the millions of elderly Chinese, and the Chinese, the Communist Party leaders now are looking at changing that one child only to raising it, even encouraging having a second child, so that there will be, same as we look at here, enough young people working to support the elderly population, well, to support the continued growth of the economy.
Yes.
Because if you've got, you know, if 25% of your people are too old to work and produce, you need to produce more young people. And, you know, we're looking at a reversal of that population policy even in China. And that, again, very scary. Anytime I bring that up, I understand exactly the dilemma you're facing. I've been in a, and I'll send you the connection to this dialogue group, but I've been in a an online conversation, discussion group about population for the last, oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a huge, it's a huge issue. And it's so, people just, they get their backs up if you bring this up, that at both ends of life, the birth end and the death end,
oh, yeah,
are opportunities for us to change the threat we are to each other and the planet by there being too many of us. You can't get somebody to, you get dirty looks. I've got friends that won't talk to me anymore because I brought this subject up. Very hard to get us to think about trimming our numbers, and yet all the way up until modern humans trimmed their numbers like every other species
right. When
it was necessary in a variety of ways, inhumane and sometimes humane.
Well, procreation is really the only thing that you can do, and no one will tell you not to do it.
That's right. You know,
it's totally legal. You can have as many as you want. There's no regulation on it. There's no nothing.
That's
and
right.
It's the only true freedom that people have. And as far as, you know, China and the United States creating people to pay for Social Security or whatever, it's creating a cheap labor force, which then drives the whole thing
exactly.
down, and it just deteriorates. And it's like, I don't see how people can't see population going up, deteriorating your way of life. I mean, okay, so 2/3 of the population gets wiped out. That 1/3 population, they should have a pretty nice life if they don't start growing and blow it up all over again. You know, it's that whole catch 22.
Yes, and it's an unmentionable for most
yes.
people. Obviously not everybody, because there are lots of people who the Ehrlichs, I mean, have been talking. Paul and Ann Ehrlich have been writing about this for what, four
mm-hmm.
decades, I suspect, by now, the population bomb and, you know, this as a central issue. One of the things that came up in this discussion group, and something I've done a little research on in this regard, the information is findable. And one of the reasons I didn't harp more on when I discovered that the economy seemed to be the globalizing of the economy seemed to be the thing that supported all these other challenges to long-term sustainability, is that the length of time, if we shrunk the population and continued to grow the economy to support in a better way fewer people, we'd still be creating the havoc we're creating, you know, with ecosystems and the climate and scarcities. Which would be faster? It would be faster to stop working economically the way we do, but that's not happening either. So, this is one of those both and. We really need to work on the population issue, and we really need to work on thinking differently about how we support ourselves. And I don't see any of those happening right off, but your job, one of yours, and certainly mine with this book and other writings, is to try to just, you know, gain a few more people that see it and share what they see with people around them.
Right, realizing what's happening and then trying to realize what is truly important. It's not the commercialism that you're being fed, which is important, but it's actually, you know, a way of life. I mean, I don't know how many people don't look up at the stars on a regular basis.
Yeah, well,
the simple
and how
things.
Many places you can no longer see them.
See the stars. Yeah, when people get out here, they're like, whoa, it's like, yeah, it's a
yes.
whole other place, you know. It's a big place.
Boy, did I notice that was one of my first, one of the first things I noticed after the move here was that, because I could go out on my porch in mid-coast Maine, you know, even though I was relatively close to a village and a couple of small towns, and I could see the northern lights, you know, and I could, the star, it was phenomenal. And here, you know, it's a small city, but it's a city, gosh, I feel really lucky if I can find Orion up there.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, since you've made a move to another part of the country, so what are the differences that you see between Maine and North Carolina? In any way.
There are things about North Carolina I love. And, we've made some wonderful friends. But politically and in terms of any of the things I write about in the book, North Carolina is one of those states that's happily, not all of it, over in the eastern part of the state, Chapel Hill, Raleigh-Durham, that area, and in the western part of the state, Asheville, there are Green Party organizations, there are localization activities, there are sustainability groups, there's lots of support for buying local, for local food production, there are transition town groups, and that's one of the ones people, you know, more people could get involved in. The people who do the transition town training, transitioning to a post-carbon, post-global way of living in the world, those people are doing really phenomenal work. And although, you know, there's no place that's made a complete transition yet, transition really is about process. And transition Town and Transition USA training. It's, you can find it online. Organizations to join. The transition movement is an important one in this country, and Asheville and Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area both have growing transition groups. But most of the state is still very much oriented toward what Marshall McLuhan called driving into the future, looking in the rearview mirror back in the day. They're still looking at more of the same business as usual, grow, give entitlements to corporations to come here. This kind of thinking is strong here, and I don't see myself being able to make any real inroads. Politically and economically, Maine was a much more congenial place for me. But in terms of the weather, I can grow vegetables here all year.
All year.
Of course, I couldn't. Well, yep. Elliot Coleman had taught us how to do that, but I couldn't as easily grow things all year as in Maine as I can here.
I'm trying to get his daughter Melissa, actually.
Oh, good. Yes, good, good.
But do you notice?
I worked with. That was another piece of my own personal teaching. I worked with Helen Nearing for the last 12 years of her life, right after Scott died. I had been an editor at Farmstead Magazine, which came out of Freedom, Maine,
mm-hmm.
and that was a national kind of local food production, wood heat, alternative energy magazine, and it gave me the opportunity to meet Helen and Scott in the last years just before he died. And after he died, I started doing what I called going to Helen. We made a connection. So I got to work with her for the last, as I say, 12 years of her life quite closely, which was a wonderful experience for me. And Elliot, of course, was a neighbor of Helen's and has developed his beautiful, phenomenal organic gardening and farming techniques and books on land that Helen and Scott sold to Elliot. And that's a whole other interesting story, but there's not a better gardening writer out there. There are lots of really good ones, but nobody's better than Elliot Coleman.
So do you notice down in the Carolinas, when you see a farm stand or farmer's market, are they selling stuff they grow, or are they selling like Dole and Del Monte?
Well, you've been doing your homework, or you just got really, really good instincts, Tim.
We have
here... I think around where I am here, there must be a good 20 sort of farm stands, various sizes of farm garden markets now. And a couple of them swear to and actually follow through on all local. And a number of them, one of the ones downtown here, for example, in Winston-Salem, I mean, you look at the boxes and they've brought this stuff from South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, you know, tomatoes, peaches, whatever, they're coming from someplace else, and they're just sold there. So, no, they are not all here in North Carolina. But the small ones, the small stands are, and some of the urban farmers markets have made a point of, there's one here in Winston called Cobblestone that's really quite, in fact, I'm going there after we finish our conversation this morning. And there's one between here and Greensboro that is pretty much entirely, I think the outside sellers are pretty much entirely local, local regional. I mean, they may come from, you know, the other side of North Carolina, but, you know, we're talking 200, 250 miles, not 1,000 miles or whatever.
Well, see, this is what's puzzling me, because I used to come up the coast. We lived in Florida and had relatives in Maryland, and then I lived in Maryland for quite a while.
Well, I did too. I grew up in Towson.
Oh, Frederick, where the rednecks are, Fredneck.
Yeah.
But what I noticed is in the 60s, late 70s, early 80s, all those farm stands were doing regional stuff. It was like all regional. And I'm trying to figure out exactly when everything went crazy, because it's actually not that long ago. You know, I mean, a lot of people were oblivious to it and the stores took over. But when there were farm stands, they were real.
Yeah. And yeah, actually, my adulthood. I just turned 65 this year, which I don't feel it. I look in the mirror and I think, how did that happen?
But
Yeah, no, it's I remember as a kid, I grew up in northern suburb of Baltimore, which then was a really small suburb, and now it's humongous and goes out three or four or five sub-suburbs, exurbs out from Towson. But I remember the farm stands, the neighborhood, you know, somebody in the neighborhood would be raising stuff in their backyard and have it, the kids would be out by the street selling it.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, was when it became cheaper, because transportation was so cheap, when it became cheaper to buy the stuff from somebody else and resell it, and it was less work, that's what you did.
Well,
you know, you acquired it someplace else, it was less work, you could get it for, you know, $1 a pound and sell it for $2 or $3 a pound, then why sweat in the backyard or out in the back 40 or whatever raising it? You could still sell it out front. And so kids, you know, in my generation were leaving home. They weren't staying there to help farm. So a lot of those farmers got older. And as they got older, it was harder to do the work, and the kids weren't there helping them. So it was easier to acquire it from someplace else.
Right, where Frederick is used to be big dairy and all that, and that's pretty much dwindling, and, you know, it's becoming suburbs. Ongoing thing. And my girlfriend has the same problem. She starts I mean, it's weird because you're putting again, it's going back to money. You're putting a dollar amount on what it's worth. So when you put a dollar's amount on that tomato, I mean, the tomato is basically $10. And you can, yes, I can go out and get it cheaper somewhere else. But then again, it's to me, I try telling people all the time, they go, oh, food's getting expensive. I said, food's nowhere where it needs to be price-wise. This is the most important thing. This is what keeps you healthy, wealthy and wise, and you don't want to spend any money on it. You're more thinking about that iPod that's going to break in 4 months or whatever than you are about what you're putting into your body. And it's, and it's constantly when the politicians talk, it's like cheap food, cheap oil, you know, that's all they talk about. And in the reality, that's what is screwing it up. And I don't know if I, like, it's, I don't know. I guess I go to the 80s, and I don't want to blame it on Ron there for doing his bit. But, I mean, I guess that's when I started noticing the changes, because then that's when, you know, he was pushing the concept that everything's great and we got to, like, expand the economy. And then that's when, basically, fuel economies went down. You know, the 40-mile-a-gallon car wasn't there anymore. And then we just started going back to the 50s, basically.
And it, part, I mean, again, it came down to what we did with money, you know, allowing it to detach further and further from from being connected to anything real, the shortages of which would determine how much money, or the limitations on which, like the gold standard, would determine how much money there could be. I mean, that gold standard was dropped in the 70s, and that's exactly when this happened. Precisely so that we could expand the amount of money infinitely, we thought. But even that has its limits, because if you expand the amount of it, every bit of it, every piece of paper is worth less than it was. I mean, inflation is just is part of the process. And we saw that as a good thing, because it it freed us up to purchase and produce for a global market, and that's what we thought we needed to do, and was the best thing.
I never thought of the gold standard as a limitation, sort of like a safety belt in a sense. And that makes total sense.
You could only have as much money as you could back it. At that point, gold. I mean, there in colonial times and before that, tobacco, rice, wheat, grains, other metals, an enormous number of things at one time or another in money's history have been the resource to which the value and quantity of money was attached. And when we detached it from any limitable resource, which we did in the 70s globally, then it could expand theoretically forever, except that forever has a price tag.
Right, not reality.
That's right.
Interesting. Okay, well, you have anything else to say? I know we could probably keep going forever here. But I do want to read this. It's just, it says, to be resourceful is to renew, restore, refresh, reclaim, refine, replenish, restock, recycle, recirculate, reuse, refurbish, reconstitute, refill, regenerate, rehabilitate, re-inhabit, repair, rebuild, retrieve, revitalize. And this comes from your book.
Yes.
That's very interesting.
And that's, I mean, this is how living systems, which, again, the heart of the book, I mean, its job, in my mind, was, and I didn't invent all of this thinking, some of it's original, but a lot of it, a lot of the purpose, the central purpose of this book was to create a context for the brilliant thinking and writing of lots of other people, like Bill McKibben and James Hansen and Paul Hawken and Wendell Berry and Thomas Berry, to pull that thinking together in a way that would make it would make some of these understandings clearer to more people. And so its job is to explain how we got in the mess we're in, you know, why we're here, what's the cause of the problems, the fact that they all connect together, and, you know, we can't fix one of these things at a time. We have to look at it as a complex of problems, and then to create a context for understanding what we need to do. And that context is life itself, the way life works on this planet. My key central line is, if we want to create life ways that are sustainable, we need to create life ways that mimic life ways. And if we were to revise, to use another reword from that list, if we were to revise, reconceive the way we live, so that it harmonized with and mimicked the way living systems have succeeded sustainably in doing this for 2 billion years, we could make high quality, highly humane, kindly, very democratic, thoughtful, sustainable lives for ourselves as a species, as communities, as families, as individuals, well into the future. And the last part of the book looks at ideas that are out there already, tools, technologies, techniques that already exist, that if we understand them as aspects of mimicking the way life works, we can put to work for ourselves at any time.
Right. Well, I mean, these are answers that a lot of us have. I mean, because you talk about having the different writers and stuff, and I mean, we all know what's inside. I believe a lot of us really know what's going on, and we know what has to be done. It's just making the step mm-hmm. and starting to do it is the hard part. And once
That's
you start
right.
doing
and
it, it's not going to be that bad.
Because we can't do these things. There are a lot of things we can do as individuals, but they won't change. What we do as individuals will not change the fact that the system's heading for collapse.
Right.
And if we could, before it collapsed, prepare ourselves, it would be a good thing. After collapse, we'll have no choice, and there'll be a lot of scrambling and a lot of loss of life and a lot of probably violence and conflict that mm-hmm. could be avoided. I'd like to think we'll avoid it, and some of us will, but we're going to get there. It's just whether by choice or whether we're forced.
Right. A little scary.
Mm-hmm. But it can be, for people that are actually undertaking these things, it's also full of hope and healing, and it's a real feel-good journey to get on if you understand why you're getting on it and you have family or friends or colleagues who are on the journey with you. It, like you said, you can get up in the morning and feel a whole lot better, mm-hmm. healthier, happier, less stressed if you begin to tackle these things instead of denying them, putting them off, waiting for them to come and get you. It's like not wanting to know the people, a lot of people don't want to know that they have a sickness. You know, don't tell me I have cancer. I don't want to know that. But until you know you have a condition, you can't work on healing it. You can't get better. And I guess that's how I view my job, as being one of those people that helps a few other people know we have a condition here.
Right.
And we'd feel a lot better and live a lot longer if we dealt with it.
Yeah, I mean, basically keeping it simpler, which is, I mean, I don't know. I mean, lives aren't really that complicated. I like when
That's
people
right.
are always saying things are so much more harder than they used to be. It's like, oh, my God. I mean, it
yeah,
used to be
when
hard.
You realize that what we call primitive peoples only work about 2 or 3 hours a day to provide themselves with what they need. Yeah, we might not want to duplicate their whole life way, but we could be a lot less stressed, working a lot less hard, and providing actual real things for ourselves and each other, things we actually need.
Okay, so that I don't really know much about the Nerians, but I remember someone, a farmer, talking about how they were saying, okay, you work 4 hours a day or something, and the rest is like free time, which they're going, I don't understand how that works. But as we're talking here, I guess I understand how it works, because again, it's like being in a sustainable way, getting what you need with a little bit of surplus, not like abundance.
Right.
You know, because like a lot of the farmers, I mean, they're producing more and more and more, but then commodity prices go down and down and down. So it really doesn't pay to work the 12-hour day. So if you simplify your life.
To produce stuff for sale. And then, and so many farmers, I don't know if you've seen this in Vermont since you've been there, but in the 25 years I was in Maine, I watched a lot of farmers move from also having large gardens and providing, you know, their own food for themselves, to being so busy raising the chickens for market or the cows for dairy to sell that they didn't have the time or energy left to raise any of their own food, and they were going to the supermarket with me,
right,
you know, or with the neighbors down the street. And actually, they would have had to work a lot less hard if they, at two jobs plus the farming, if they had, you know, continued to raise their own food.
Right, because you're competing against something that you can't compete against.
That's,
you know,
right.
10,000. I mean, it's like we have a chicken place here that they were doing really good, and then it's like the senator goes, oh, well, let's give you some grant money and make you bigger. So now you're taking the sustainable.
You've got to compete with Purdue from down here.
I know. And so you're taking something that seems to be working, but it's always the push for bigger and better, which then makes it collapse.
And, of course, the bank owns more of you when you do that, until the point where they really own you.
Right.
Everything you do is about making sure you can pay the bank back, the whole mortgage fiasco.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, just it's a vicious circle. It's a treadmill. It's the little hamster,
right,
on the big wheel. It just doesn't stop. And people got, I guess, eventually just stop. And again,
yeah,
supporting your local economies and stuff, and you're going to pay more, but then maybe, you know, those people will be able to help your business out. And that's.
Well, and you're only going to pay more so long as you persist in using the money that's part of that global economy, and only so long as that global economy functions.
Right.
You know, if you create a local money to go with the local business, you can pin that local money to hours of work or some resource that most of the communities that have created their own local currencies have pinned it to hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, that money moves around in the economy at a price level. Things are priced at a level people can actually afford. The price of things is determined now by this global economy. It doesn't need to be. We can create monetary systems, create new monetary systems that price things at an appropriate value for everybody.
Exactly. Well, I mean,
and that's in the book too.
And that book is Life Rules by Ellen LaConte, and that would be ellenlaconte.com if you want to check it out and see more stuff. Well, I guess we're going to have to wrap this up. It was very exciting.
I'm not sure how we would fill 2 hours, but I guess when talking to you, Tim, it's not difficult.
Yeah, I know, and if you would have made it up here, you would have had dinner. But if you ever come up, there's dinner for you. So.
Okay.
So is there any way, so let's wrap this up then. What are your final words for these people out here?
Open your eyes if you can and dare. Look at what's going on around you. You're seeing the beginnings of the collapse of the systems you're used to. But if you get together with friends and family and read books like mine and think about what it is you really value and need in your life, you can meet this crisis. We can all together deal with this and come out the other side stronger, like Americans used to be.
Wow. Words to live by, Ellen. Well, thank you very, very much for your time. It was a pleasure after waiting months for this moment.
Yes, it was a great pleasure for me, too, and an honor, Tim.
And now I can read your book, so I feel good.
Oh, yes, now you can. And let me know afterwards what you think of it.
For sure I will. Okay, well, you have a great day, and thanks for your time and your work.
Okay, you too, Tim.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye. And there you go. You know, there's a lot of opinions out there. There's a lot of people doing things. There's a lot of people that probably think just like you. And the whole thing is making those steps. making the moves, making things change, and the whole thing is change. Change is hard. I don't change well. I fight change. I try to change, and I do change, and sometimes I think everything I do is just perfect. But times are changing, and they're changing fast. And the question is, will you change with them, or will they pass you by, and then you'll be going, oh my God, doom and gloom. Doom and gloom can be a good time. You just gotta buckle down and get into it. And that means supporting one another, getting along somewhat, not meaning that everyone in this valley will get along, because differences are what make it an interesting place to live. So, start educating yourself. Start looking around, for one thing, and seeing what's around you. Because the warning signs are all around you. The question is, do you choose to see them?